I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk to Jerry Rice, considered the greatest receiver in the history of the NFL, about his journey from rural Mississippi to the Hall of Fame. And we'll continue talking football with former Raiders coach Tom Flores, who led the Silver and Black to two Super Bowl titles. He writes about it all in his book, Tales from the Oakland Raiders. And Darrell Evans, probably the most underrated player in baseball history, will share his thoughts about the ups and downs of his 21-year career. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Jerry Rice. I had the pleasure of watching Rice's career from the day he was drafted by the 49ers through 20 seasons and now into the NFL Hall of Fame. Coach Bill Walsh saw something special in Rice, even though he played his college ball at Little Mississippi Valley State. His early NFL years were marked by inconsistency and drop passes. But when his career was over, Rice had won three Super Bowls with the Niners, owned 38 different NFL records, including records for receptions, yards, and touchdowns. Also, Rice had the good fortune of being on the receiving end of passes thrown by two of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game, Joe Montana and Steve Young. Even after his playing days were over, Rice proved he still had the moves as he competed in television's Dancing with the Stars. Whatever Jerry Rice has done in his life, he's done it full out and with great success. He wrote about his life on and off the field in his book, Go Long, My Journey Beyond the Game and Fame. I asked him why he wrote the book.
I wanted people with this book. I just really didn't want this to be just a sports book. I wanted people to know about my childhood, about going to Mississippi Valley State, then, the adversity coming here to San Francisco and not having confidence at times. And it was almost like it was that fear of failure, you know, that was driving me. My father, he was a bricklayer, and I would go out and work with him. And if I didn't do my job, he would discipline me. So I never wanted to let him down. Then I never wanted to let the San Francisco 49ers down or the fans.
So the fear of failure was something that drove you pretty strongly.
Yeah, it pushed me. It pushed me. So, and I never got complacent. I never felt like I arrived. You know, you would hear people say, well, you know, you are the best receiver to play the game. I never looked at it that way. You know, I just continued to work hard. I would go to training camp, and I would play head games with myself. It was a scenario where I just felt, hey, I'm a rookie here. I have to prove myself to make this football team, and that was my approach for years.
How did you deal with mediocrity when you ran into it, either on a teammate or just generally speaking in life then?
You know what?
I mean, that's got to be tough when you're somewhat of a perfectionist like yourself.
I was always searching for that perfect game. I was always searching for it, and I never got it because, you know, I could have a game where I have 8 to 10 catches, over 160 yards, three scores or something like that, and I go back and I look at that, and I say, wow, you know, I missed that block. You know, that block could have, opened the door for Roger Craig or something like that. So I was always searching for it, and I think I was driven by it.
When you go back and you think about where you came from in Mississippi and now where you are today, all you've accomplished, I mean, it's got to be mind-blowing. Because I knew Jerry Rice when he was a rookie, an unpolished rookie, had trouble putting sentences together,
right.
Overwhelmed by the media, was right. Dropping passes early in his career. I mean, to me, it's a time warp. It just is mind-blowing to see how far you have come.
You know what? I never go back. I really don't. I'm always moving forward. And I think I've been blessed because, you know, I've been around so many great people. And, you know, Eddie DeBartolo, Carmen Policy, Dwight Clark, Freddie Solomon, Joe Montana, Steve Young, just so many guys. And I sat back and I watched those guys and how they dealt with the media. And it was hard for me at first, but I think I have grown a lot, you know, coming from a small school like Mississippi Valley State University, coming into San Francisco where you got legends, you know, Montana from Notre Dame, Ronnie Lott from USC, Jerry Rice from Mississippi Valley State University.
What's wrong with this? Let me read what it says in the book because I think it's very telling. It's from the foreword with Bill Walsh. He says, I remember it like it was yesterday, though now it's been more than 20 years. It was the first day of the San Francisco 49ers minicamp in June 1985, and most of our veterans and recent draft picks had gathered at our practice facility to begin preparing to defend our Super Bowl title, which we had won just 5 months earlier. It didn't take very long that first day of practice for players and coaches alike to stop and stare at the new kid on the block. A few even gave me an approving nod. A 6'2" physical specimen, first-round draft pick Jerry Rice, was so explosive at every step that I think we were all in shock. I knew right away that Jerry was destined for greatness. He was so unusual, so different in his style and movements, in the way he glided along the field and absorbed the ball on the move. I had never seen anything like it. What was it like for you, 1985? I know what Bill says.
I was scared to death. Scared and just wanted to fit in. I wanted to find my place, and I think at first when I caught the football and I started running, some of the guys looked at me like, young guys trying to show off a little bit. But it was just that I wanted to impress, because when you come from a small school like that, you got so many people doubting you, and I knew I had to find my place, and I had to work my butt off, and I was able to do that. And I think the guys, they appreciated that.
What is the difference between coming out of USC, Florida State, Michigan, Ohio State, and Mississippi Valley State when you're drafted?
I think playing in the big games, being in the spotlight, knowing how to deal with the media, and for me, I had to learn on the go. It was, just like Dancing with the Stars. I had to learn on the go, and no one is going to have sympathy for you, because you're going to have to learn fast and you're going to have to adapt. And I was able to do that. And I was also, I think the most important thing, I was able to keep everything in perspective. I never lost sight. If I had success, I wanted to give that success, I wanted to credit my teammates. And because, football is not an individual game, it's a team sport.
Culturally, what was it like coming to San Francisco?
Scared to death. What are you talking about? Hey, coming from a very, very, small town, then all of a sudden you come to the big city and you got lights, camera, action. I'm like, oh, my God. I stepped off the plane. I wanted to turn around and go back home. But, I fought through that. And when I first came in also, it was one of those scenarios where, my agent, he wanted to change me, being this country boy. So, I had a speech therapist. I went through all of that. And I said, Jerry, you just got to be yourself. You be yourself, everything else is going to work out.
Was there anything that was a little bit embarrassing at the beginning for you?
My country accent, yeah. Yeah,
I remember it.
Yeah. I was straight up country. I'm still country.
Those early days in the camp, you mentioned about kind of having to prove yourself again. You're absolutely right. You have to check your ego at the door. And probably for somebody that comes out of a small school like you, you have to show them that you deserve to be there.
Right, exactly. And I had my work cut out for me, and I was ready for it, because I have always worked hard. That's one thing about me. I never want anything to be given to me. But I had to prove to those guys that I deserve to be on that field and also be the starter.
When you came in, Joe Montana was here, of course, quarterback. The team had come off winning a Super Bowl. What was the atmosphere on that team?
Well, I just felt we would go back to the Super Bowl, because of the guys and the legacy. The dynasty, the dynasty was unbelievable because the track record. The best quarterback, the best owner, the best coach, so many great players. I just felt like we would go back, and came up a little short. And I still remember that game against the New York Giants. I caught that slant pattern, and I was off to the races, and all of a sudden that ball popped out and it was rolling on the ground. And after that, we never did gain momentum from that. I think that one play taught me that I have to protect the football.
Was that the game also that Jim Burt hit Joe Montana?
No, that was the one here in San Francisco.
Okay, because I remember that. I mean, I thought he had been knocked into Thursday.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Jerry, you talked about your work ethic. I know that goes back to the family. You and I have talked about your dad and everything. But if you had to define it down to the minutest point, what is it about Jerry Rice that has that burning work ethic desire?
I think it's just that I'm just hungry. I'm hungry. I like challenges. Football is something that I'm not going to be able to replace that. It's just no way. That was 20 years of just excitement for me, and I poured my heart into that. But, you know, I have other things I want to accomplish off the football field now. I have a reality show that I'm going to start with TLC that I'm very excited about. It's going to be called Jerry Rice's Life Squad. It's going to be very inspirational. And I wanted TLC to take this on because I wanted it to be a family show. So I'm excited about that. Then working with Eddie DeBarlow again, doing Sirius Radio, and just dabbing in so many things, and I'm having a great time.
Was it hard for you to get to the end of your career? Because you love this game so much. I always sensed that it was going to be difficult for you to take off the uniform the last time.
Yeah, it was hard for me to get to the end. I have to be honest with you. And Mike Shanahan, we talked about that, and he told me, he said, Jerry, if you come to Denver, I'm always going to be straight up with you. I'm going to tell you if you're going to make the team or if you're going to be able to play a significant part. It didn't work out for me. I decided that it was time for me to walk away. And after that, I did some other things. I did pros and joes and stuff like that, trying to find my way because it's hard to make that transition. A lot of guys cannot make that transition after football.
And also, when you did make that decision, did you not look back? Did you second guess it to any degree, or was it done and over?
You know what? Of course not. You're going to look back. You're going to look back, and you're going to look and say, hey, look, I'm better than that guy. You know, I should still be out there on that football field. Some of the receivers, you know, you had some guys dropping footballs all over the place. I think one of my fellow teammates, Terrell Owens, he led the league with drops. He had 18. Randy Moss wanted to play at times. Then he didn't want to play. But, yeah, you look at that and say, hey, you know, I would love to be back out there again.
Jerry Rice has joined us here on Sports Byline. Again, I want you to check out this book because it's not just a football book. It's a life story as well. It's called Go Long, My Journey Beyond the Game and the Fame. I alluded to it before the break. The man that you called your West Coast father, we're referring to, of course, Bill Walsh. First time you met him, did you meet him when he was scouting you, or when did you first meet Bill?
When I got drafted by the Niners and I came in town and I looked at this guy, silver hair, and I said, that guy, you know, and he had the nickname Genius, and it was just amazing because without Bill Walsh, I really don't think I would have gotten drafted by the San Francisco 49ers. And because the Dallas Cowboys, I think they had the next pick, and somehow Bill decided to make a trade, slide down one slot in front of the Cowboys, and they chose me.
Do you know why he chose you?
You know, just reading that, I think because he was so impressed with the way I was able to run my routes and the way I really, you know, just snatched the football out of the air. And I guess it was real, it was like, it was just perfect. And he took a chance. The guy, he was able to see down the road. And that was something that was really special. And I think Bill pretty much took me on his wings. And when I was having adversity, he just told me, Jerry, look, just keep working hard. He said, you're going to be good, you know, in this in the NFL. Just keep working.
Let me tell you a little bit, because I've talked to him about this. And I asked him, I said, what was it about Jerry Rice that you saw that you liked? He said, I had talked to some people in Mississippi who talked to me about the way he conducted himself. So I knew he was disciplined. He said, you could see on tape that he had an explosive first step. And he said, that's what I looked for as well. And then the third thing that caught my attention from a technical standpoint, he told me, was the way he finished the play. He said, I put all three of those things together, and I felt he was going to be a star.
Wow. Wow. And it's just amazing because Bill really just played a very important part in my life. And we talked about this and we would laugh about this. And Bill used to tell me, he said, you need to retire. You need to retire. You're playing too long. You know, I want to be the one to introduce you, induct you into the hall. And we talked about that. So I really want this guy to fight through this because he's been a father. He's been everything to me. And I think it's only appropriate that, you know, he's the one to induct me into the Hall.
I was recently having lunch with him, and I asked him about why he was so interested in diversification, meaning as far as that he didn't care if you were black, purple, pink, whatever it was. And he said, I grew up in Los Angeles, and he said, the community that I grew up in, we were poor but didn't know we were poor. So he could relate to your background. And he said, there were people that spoke Italian, they spoke Spanish, you know, there were guys from the hood and everything. He said, so I never saw things in terms of black and white, and I always felt that that was one of the strengths of him in molding this football team. He looked for production and really knew how to manipulate. And I use
oh,
that
yes,
in a
he did. Yeah. Oh, yes, he did.
You and everybody else to play their best game.
Yeah, and I had a game against a team. I think I had like 8 to 10 catches. I had 2 scores. I had over 100 yards or more. And Bill brought me into his office. And I'm thinking he's going to pat me on my back and say, hey, Jerry, great game, stuff like that. He looked at me, and he was serious. He looked at me, and he said, I need more from you. And he really meant that. But later on, I found out he brought in Joe Montana. He brought in all the other guys, too. So he knew how to motivate players. And you don't see a lot of that in coaching right now. You know, a guy that, you know, you're willing to just go out there and just lay everything on the line for.
Yeah. Manipulation is such a negative word. But I suppose he understood what it took for players to perform at their best. Did he always give you guys the feeling that he was the captain on the bridge of the ship?
Oh, yes.
I think that means an awful lot to players to know that.
Oh, yes. You knew that he was the captain. And if you didn't go out there and perform during the week, then he was going to let you know it. You had to perform. I think Tom Rathman, he was dropping balls. And I think Tom had just came in. It was his first year. And he told Tom, you keep dropping balls like that, you're not going to be here. And Tom said that really just woke him up, because he was just straight up front with him. And, you know, Bill, he was that type of coach, and you wanted to go out there and fight for it. And I think that's why we, you know, won so many Super Bowls.
I often wondered whether he had white hair before or after Russ Francis. I mean, Russ Francis drove him absolutely nuts, because he never practiced the way he wanted him to, but he played, you know, fine when it came to the, you know, came to the game itself.
Yeah, Russ, he was one of those tough guys, man. You know, I think he flew our airplane, all of that stuff. And him and Bill, they used to go at it. But we had players, we had leaders that pretty much knew what we had to do, and to go out there and fight week in and week out. And we enjoyed, the most important thing, we enjoyed performing in front of the fans, you know. And whenever you played Candlestick Park, you knew that you had the backing of the fans, because they were going to show up and they were going to support us.
One of the things that you talk about in this book, and it surprised me, was the racism that you ran into in San Francisco. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, you're always going to face racism. You know that. It's still out there. And when I was growing up as a kid, I did the same thing. You know, to bring money into the house, I had to pick cotton. A lot of the blacks that was down south, they didn't like that. You know, they felt like you were, you know, that it was a slap, you know, against your forefathers. But still, I had to bring money into the house, and the most important thing was to feed the family. So you're always going to encounter that, but we didn't use that as an excuse. We treated everybody equal. You know, it didn't matter about your skin. And my mom, she would always say this, you know, it's not about what you have. You know, it's about, you know, just family and love. And we had a very large family, but we were very close.
But it does get old after a while. Nobody should have to deal with that.
Yeah,
Jerry?
But you don't give in to it. You know, if you face it, hey, use it as a positive. Keep trying to really achieve your goals. And I fought through it. And I don't have a racist bone in my body. And I owe that to my parents.
Does it ever bother you that you were an athlete of renown and that people would relate to you because of your success? In other words, I know Jerry Rice. I want to know Jerry Rice.
Oh, yeah. You knew that. I knew exactly what was going on there, and I knew how to deal with it. You know, you have advantages, you have disadvantages. But the thing about me, I didn't let that stop me from being a leader. You know, if you put me down or something like that, I came back. I came back fighting. I wanted to prove you wrong.
Let's talk about your two quarterbacks for a moment. You say in the book about Joe Montana against Steve Young. Explain why you kind of lean in the direction of Joe Montana being the better quarterback.
Well, because I had a better chemistry with him. And that was the first guy I started with. With Steve, I completely, everything I developed with Joe, I had to, you know, slide that under the rug. Because Steve was a lefty. He was known as a runner. So I had to adjust my game to Steve. And we were able to really be productive out on the football field. And we broke so many records. So, you know, I think with Joe, it was just that magic, though. I knew that what this guy was thinking at all time. But, you know, I'm just very fortunate to have had two Hall of Famers. You know, that doesn't happen. That's very unusual. And those guys, you know, they did a fantastic job.
Well, you know what they say about left-handers. They're a little bit different.
They're a little different, yeah.
Mechanically, Jerry, though, a left-handed thrower to a receiver compared to a right-handed thrower.
Different spin.
Oh, it is.
Different spin on the football. The ball is going to come in, spin in this direction, opposite. And also, that was my first time ever catching from a lefty. So I had this trainer, Ted Walsh. He was an equipment guy. Ted and I, we used to spend so much time after practice, and he would throw me the football until I felt comfortable with it. And I think that's when Steve and I, you know, started taking off.
You've talked about this before, and I know the story about the Super Bowl when Joe said, look at Joe, John Candy on the sideline and everything. But what was the key to his deportment in the huddle that made him so successful?
The coolness.
Yeah.
The coolness, man. It was unbelievable. You could knock this guy around. You could do whatever. He never pointed any fingers. And I remember that a final drive when Joe came in and he was pulling grass. Harris Barton, he was talking about John Candy and stuff like that. I don't remember anything about that. But I remember Joe pulling grass, and he started barking out the signals. Then we broke the huddle, and it was complete quietness. And just to watch this guy at work, you know, just like a surgeon. And you knew that he was going to make the right plays and put you in a position to win.
Yeah, I remember Randy Cross and I were on a trip to Afghanistan recently, and he told me about that drive, and Harris, I think, was throwing up in the huddle, you know. That's when Joe looked over and said, hey, look, there's John Candy.
It was unbelievable. But we, and you know, in a scenario like that, you get a chance to practice that drill once a week.
We're going to talk about Ed DiBartolo, Jr. I had dinner with him down in Tampa maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and he said to me, he said, I know when he said, let's have dinner, he wanted to talk about something. He said, well, I have a chance to get back in the NFL and to buy a team. And I looked at him. I said, if you do, I'm not going to talk to you for a year. And he said, why? I said, simply because of the fact that you can't replicate what you did with the 49ers. And I know you being very close to him as well, that period of time I've almost said it's like Camelot. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a fair depiction of what that period of time was like?
Yeah, it was just like magic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you could ever duplicate that again, but I think he had some interest in the Raiders and also the Jacksonville Jaguars. And I remember talking to Eddie. He said, you know, I really want to get back into it. Then all of a sudden, it didn't happen, and he decided to, like I said, start this agency to represent guys right now. So Eddie is like the closer, you know. He's the big guy on campus, and they bring him in to close the deal. And I think we're just having a great time because I realize how important it is to have a good agent, you know, when you first come in. When I first came in, I had a bad guy. You know, he took money, he did everything, and I think that really, that was a distraction for me. So these guys that we're bringing on board here, you know, we want to really get them started on the right foot so they don't have to worry about that and they can just focus on football.
What was it about him that made him so unique? I know people say he spent a lot of money, but he did truly create a family atmosphere that I suppose all teams try to do that, but he was able to do it. Why was he able to do it, Jerry?
I think because he was just like a player. He was that 12th man. He put players out there in a position to win. You don't see a lot of that happening right now, but you had players willing to take pay cuts to come to the San Francisco 49ers and just play for Eddie DiBartolo because everything was first class. It was it didn't get any better. And I think that's why we had so much success is because the organization, they were so top class. and we didn't have to worry about anything upstairs. We just played football, and we had a great time doing it.
Well, the other story, which I've recounted a number of times, is the Jeff Fuller story where he got hurt in the ball game. I believe it was down at Stanford.
Right,
when
it was Stanford.
Playing.
Right.
And his career ended that day with one hit. And Eddie then took out an annuity for hundreds of thousands of dollars that made sure that this young man got that.
But
every
I'm not
year.
Surprised by
no,
that.
No.
Not at all. You know, Eddie, one of, without a doubt, one of the best owners. But not only an owner, but, you know, as a friend. And that's the same thing. That's the type of family that we're trying to start now with this agency. And I don't know if you're ever going to see a football team as close as we were. It was just unbelievable because you had Eddie DeBarlow, Carmen Policy, Bill Walsh, and just so many great people. And it was just great being a part of that organization.
I've said this before, and correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, but I always said the strength of the 49ers and the reason for their success was that when somebody came onto the team, into the organization, it was not Bill Walsh, it wasn't Carmen. It was the players that went to him and say, look, this is the way we do it here.
Right, right. And a lot of stuff that's happening in the NFL, you know, you just shake your head with Terrell Owens. You know, I hate to use him as an example, but, you know, this guy, he did a lot of damage here in San Francisco. Then he went on to Philadelphia and on to Dallas. Back in the day, some of those big guys, they would have went to work on Terrell Owens.
Yeah, he would not have gotten away with that. Let me take you back to 1996, because you were expecting your third child, and it probably was the most testing of a human being, both from a faith standpoint and also from a human standpoint as well. Take me through that year and what you went through with Jackie.
A lot. A lot. We were expecting our third child, and you know, we thought it was going to be just like that. Thought it was going to happen. We couldn't wait. We knew that it was a, you know, a little girl. And after my wife gave birth, she started bleeding. Then everything just went downhill. And you know, I was there, but it was almost like I was not there because I couldn't do anything. You know, I was in a room. I was waiting. And you could tell something serious was going on because, you know, the doctors, the nurses started running around. And before we knew it, you know, Jackie was, she was really, really sick. And she almost died.
Yeah, you say in the book about the recovery, coming out of the recovery room and the sheets were all bloodied
right.
and everything.
I couldn't, really didn't recognize her at all.
Yeah.
But I felt I had to be there. I had to be the strong one in the family and because her mom was there, you know, for the kids and for everyone else. And that was hard. That was hard, you know, seeing someone that you really love, you know, go through that and something that's supposed to be natural. I mean, giving childbirth and stuff like that. And it just brought to perspective that so many women die from this. We just don't know about it. And I'm happy to say, you know, Jackie, she was able to pull through.
What did you learn about yourself through that ordeal?
That it was just not about football.
Yeah. I knew you were going to say that.
That it was not about football. It's about life. And I was there for her, and we were able to, pull Jackie, through this, tough situation.
I was at the stadium when they retired your number, and I was up in the box with Ed DeBartolo, and I kind of smiled, and Bill Walsh was there as well. And I listened to your daughter sing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, she's a beautiful girl. She's back at Georgetown. We're so proud of her. Then my son, he's 15. So, you know, I go to ball games, and I'm just a parent. I'm a parent. But the thing, you know, my father, he never said, I love you. You know, but you knew he did, but he never said. And I tell my kids this all the time. I love them. And, you know, if you need anything, I'm there to support you. Then I got this 10-year-old that's like 20.
That's a good thing you have no hair because
right,
it would
right.
be gray.
Correct.
The name of this book is Go Long, My Journey Beyond the Game and the Fame. And let's talk about some of the things that are in the book. You talk very candidly about the use of steroids, about Barry Bonds and Bill Romanowski. What do you feel about it?
I'm totally against it. You, as an athlete, you know exactly what you put in your body, and you just don't make excuses. You know, you if you get caught for it, you know, own up to it. I think Jason Giambi, he did. He came out and said, "Hey, I made a mistake." And this guy, he was like, you know, the comeback kid. So I'm totally against it, and I think it really sets a bad example.
Is it a self-esteem issue? I've often said that it is, in that players who don't believe enough in their ability do it because they feel they have to have an edge artificially.
I think they're just trying to get an edge. They're trying to get that separation. And for me, I wanted to do it the right way. I worked my butt off. It was, you know, sweat and tears, and I think I did okay. So you can do it the right way.
It'll be a long time before we see another receiver as good as Jerry Rice. Across the bay from San Francisco is Oakland, and that's where Tom Flores had his great sports success. Flores wasn't a superstar player, but he became a Super Bowl-winning head coach not once, but twice with the Raiders. The Raiders have always been a unique organization, starting at the top with their owner, Al Davis. His motto has always been, "Just win, baby." Flores did just that, as he is only one of two men to have a Super Bowl ring as a player, an assistant coach, and a head coach. He played quarterback for the Silver and Black for six seasons and then coached them to a championship in 1980 as the first wildcard team to win a Super Bowl. He won his second ring in 1983. Even though he went to later coach the Seattle Seahawks, he's most remembered for his long tenure as a player and a coach with Oakland. And he wrote about it all in his book, Tales from the Oakland Raiders. I asked Flores the obvious first question: what is it about the Raiders as an organization and a team that makes them so different?
I just think it's the atmosphere that was created through the years by the organization. And, you know, and you have to give a lot of that credit to Al Davis when he came, because Al, you know how he is. He's always been a mysterious type of person and likes to be known as a kind of a mystique type of individual. But we never laundered our stuff in the public. Everything that was done, we tried to keep it in-house, and we allowed players to be their personalities develop, some of them a little wacky, but we control them as long as they did what we wanted them to do, and that was play football, study hard, work hard, and win football games, and don't embarrass the organization. You know, it's not a perfect system, but once you establish that kind of a legacy, that kind of an atmosphere, the players every year hand it over to somebody else. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, 10 years from now, whether that will continue, because today's modern player is a lot different than the players when I coached and when I played, as far as their commitment to an organization or their loyalties and their camaraderie.
Take me back to how you got involved with this organization first as a player.
Well, I came out of College of Pacific and now University of Pacific in Stockton, and I went to Canada and failed there. I had shoulder surgery. Tried out with the Redskins in 59, failed there. And then in 60, when the American Football League started, they were signing anybody. Oakland got the last franchise available. They were originally, it was originally given to Minnesota, but they gave it to Oakland. And a bunch of guys got together, a bunch of Chet Soda and Wayne Valley and Ed McGaw and about 20 limited partners all got together and put up, you know, $5,000, $25,000 a piece, you know, big money in those days. And we were born. And so I signed. There were 11 quarterbacks the first day of camp in Santa Cruz. We all couldn't get one picture. I mean, it was almost a zoo. And somehow we survived, we persevered, and who would have thought that it would grow to what it is today? We played our first games were in Kezar Stadium. And then we ended up playing in Candlestick, and then the last three games of the 60 year, and then the entire 61, then we started the little Frank Yule Field in Oakland. So I've been with them since day one, and that's what the book reflects from day one and all the way through my career with the Raiders.
Tom, let me go back to day one of the AFL and the Oakland Raiders as well. Those were very interesting days. The league was born out of a desire to take on the established National Football League. What was it like in those early days?
Well, we got second billing, third billing. I mean, we were behind the rodeo and the ping pong tournaments. Very rarely did we ever make any front page in the sporting news. San Francisco treated us like we were, you know, they said, those guys. And but in most of the players were great. The 49er players, they were great. I mean, they were, you know, because they respected our abilities. Our, you know, our abilities weren't any different than them, than theirs. But we didn't have as many good players as the National Football League did. So, and plus it created more jobs, and we weren't hurting anybody. We weren't hurting their gate at all. And, but it was we would be back east, and they'd look at us and say, "Are you guys professional football players?" And said, "Yeah." Sometimes we'd say we're truck drivers, and we would be paged once in an airport. We were paged as, "Will the Oklahoma Raiders please report to gate 2? Your plane is leaving." So we, you know, I think the funny things would happen like that. Some of the traveling, I mean, we would go back east and play Buffalo, Boston, New York, and our travel agent would stay in New York, and we didn't even know where we were supposed to go or what plane or what station we were to get off of when we took a train. It was a unique experience, and we were just having fun. The guys that were playing played because they loved the game, and we were having fun.
Yeah, I mean, there are stories about players when they got their paychecks, they go right to the bank with their uniforms and their cleats on.
Well, I never went with my uniform, but I went right down there. And one time we went to the bank over by Lake Merritt in Oakland, and we sat there and waited until they had money, funds. And then we took it in cash. in New York City, Harry Wismer on the team, and there were checks bouncing all over town, and they had a little model. Let's get this one for the Jipper instead. Yeah, but Harry Wismer was an interesting guy. We played it in the Polo Grounds. Have you ever been? Do you remember the Polo Grounds?
I remember the Polo Grounds. Oh, never been there, but I remember them.
It was dark and ugly, and they were rat infested. And we'd be sitting there, and tonight's attendance, 25,400. And we turn around, and where? I mean, they must have been counting the animals in the park because there weren't 25,000. But that was Harry Wismer. He was a dramatic type of guy.
When you take a look at those early days, the players coming together around the league, there was a lot of talented players. Why did they not make it in the National Football League? Why was this league forced to be formed?
Well, I think there was. I think at that point it was a time where there were more players with ability to play professional football, and they didn't have many choices. Canada was the only choice, and in Canada they could only keep so many Americans, and their brand of football wasn't anything like the U.S. And so all of a sudden you have a better program starting to develop, and you had more players that were able to play professional football, and then there were some players in the National Football League that got cut. That hadn't matured yet. Lenny Dawson got cut, and he comes into our league, and he had an incredible career with the Chiefs and made the Hall of Fame. So there were players like Art Powell, who played with me, didn't make it in the NFL because they had him as a defensive back with Philadelphia. But he was a great wide receiver, and he in any era he would have been a great wide receiver. So I just think that was a time where you saw there were more players. The black players were coming out of the black colleges, and there were Buck Buchanan and big Ernie Ladd and Willie Brown and on, and all of a sudden they were making their mark in professional football in both leagues. So I think that was just a turning point as far as more players, and now there's even more players. Of course, there's 32 teams now. The NFL only had, I think, 10 teams in, and AFL started out with 8.
Yeah, I really believe that the AFL was really the incubator for the opportunity for black athletes in professional football. I mean, because there were no labels put on the athletes back then. There was a chance to develop this offense, this wide-open offense, because the NFL was rather staid to some degree. Would you agree with that statement?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, you take Washington, Washington was still all white. They had not allowed a black player until the early 60s, and I think they were almost forced to if they wanted to compete with the rest of the teams. So when you went into the 60s, there was that change, and also the change was starting to develop in the colleges, where the major colleges were now starting to recruit black athletes, into Oklahoma, into Texas, into the major colleges in order to compete, because they all, they realized, hey, these guys are they're players and they're students and they're individuals, and why not? Does this improve our programs and improve their programs?
What was that first team meeting like for the Raiders?
Well, it was Eddie Ertelatz was an interesting guy because he didn't believe in long meetings. He was at Navy. He came from Navy, and at Navy they had like 45 minutes of practice one day. They had an hour the next day. their meetings were very short. So we would meet. I mean, our meetings were half hour meetings. Our practices were sometimes 45 minutes. We would sprint everywhere we went, and we were the best conditioned team in the league. And because of that, we won six games the first year. And then the next year, we didn't improve our talent at all. We just got killed. We won two games, I think, because we just weren't good enough to compete with everybody that had gotten better. And then after that, 62 was even worse. And then 63, we finally came around when Al came to town.
Tom, you mentioned about things started to improve when Al Davis came aboard. Al Davis's background was a kid that came off the streets of Brooklyn, and he brought that attitude really to the West Coast, did he not?
Well, he always considered himself kind of a street guy, even though he wasn't, but he liked to think of it, and his attitude was that way. And, you know, me against the world, and probably still does a little bit. But he loved the game of football. He had done everything. He went to Syracuse. He never was, you know, he didn't play a lot, but he was on the squad. He was a student assistant. He was a coach in the Army. He coached at the Citadel, at USC in a great program. And then I think the best move that he ever made was when he went with Sid Gilman in 1960 in the AFL. And for 3 years, he learned as much as he could from Sid, who was a master, and developed his own personality and his own style of play and a reputation, because when he was hired, he wasn't that well known around the entire country. And I had heard of him, but I didn't know that much about it. But the very first day I met him and we got on the board, I mean, we had known each other for a half hour, and we were on the chalkboard going over what he wanted to do offensively. And I started smiling. He looked at me like, "What are you smiling about?" I said, "No, I just like what you're doing up there. It was fun for a quarterback. If you didn't like that kind of system, it was something wrong, because we're going to throw the ball and buckle up, because here we come." But he also knew how to organize a professional team. And up until that point, we were not really organized that well. And he had complete control. And he also had a great feel for talent. And immediately he brought in players. And we went from 1-13 to 10-4 in 63. So that was a big turnaround.
Tom, you mentioned about things started to improve when Al Davis came aboard. What were his expectations of players and as the team of a whole, as a coach?
Well, I think the one thing that he wanted to throw the ball up the field, and he wanted backs that could run and catch the ball out of the backfield. Speed was always a big concern of his. And we had, that's what he went out and got Art Powell in a trade. He picked Clem Daniels, who became a feature back out of the backfield. I think in 64, he got Billy Cannon, who ended up playing tight end who could run down the field. He drafted Biletnikoff. You know, these were big offensive linemen. So he had, this was what he did, and this was what they did in San Diego. That's what Sid Gilman's theory was. So he tried to surround the team and the players with quality players and then fill in between the lines.
Tom, what was the foundation of the mystique and also the philosophy and the personality of the Raiders? Because I have found it to be unique compared to other organizations. They all have a personality, but I know, you know, as most people know, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier, they give players a second chance. It's kind of an us against them. They're very close mouthed organization. It's hard to get any type of information out of them at all. And I think a lot of that's been fostered in order to maintain kind of a motivation. But what was the foundation of all of that?
Well, it's hard to say what the foundation, because it just kind of happened through the years. You don't even think about it when it's going on. But obviously, we were always a close group. Football players are a close group anyway, because they hang out together there in training camp. We were in training camp Al's first year for 9 weeks. We went to camp right after the 4th of July. We didn't break till Friday before the first league game. So all that closeness in training camps, and when you travel together, and then the way that we were protected from the outside, keep it inside. That was always stressed. Keep it inside. Everything that happens is in this room. And there was a loyalty with the players, within the players, and then there was a loyalty with the organization to the players that developed through the years. So once a Raider, always a Raider. And then that is handed down through generations from player to player. When we got a new player, he came in that locker room, he was treated just like anybody else. He wasn't treated like some outsider, which a lot of teams are there. And I've had players and former players come up and say, "God, you guys are amazing." I say, "You get together and you're just like yesterday." See, we never get together. I mean, we don't have that kind of feeling. We never had that kind of feeling when we were with the team we were with. And I said, well, that's just the way we lived. Everybody got a chance, and everybody did their thing.
Yeah. When you take a look at the players that came together in those early days, did they set the tone for the later years teams that came along? Because I've always felt that the good organizations were the ones that, when you came into them, they said, wait a minute, this is the way we do it as the Raiders.
Yeah, no question. That's what I meant by the legacy lives on because –